Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. We all make decisions every day that shape our lives in small ways. It's rare, though, to face a real crossroads, a choice between living one life and living another that's entirely different. The choices we make in those moments define us. They can also haunt us. Ingrid Maitland faced a choice like that. She writes about it in her essay, The Triangle's Sharpest Point. It's read by Zowie Ashton. You can see Zowie now in Betrayal on Broadway, opposite Tom Hiddleston and Charlie Cox. She's also a playwright. Her play, For All the Women Who Thought They Were Mad, just opened in New York.
"I don't think he's dead," said Emma, 8, putting a finger on her father's cheek. She pressed it experimentally, and the still warm flesh responded. "See," she said, triumphant. "I told you. He's just sleeping." He wasn't. He was dead. I'd watched him take his last breath. "We won't disturb him," I said, putting an arm around her. "Let's go for a walk." She hurried off to change, and I took the chance to call the doctor. Then I had a moment to take a final look at my friend and lover. He looked comfortable. His head rested against the stuffed wingback of the big chair, eyes shut. His diseased, yellowed hands crossed in his lap, palms open. I smoothed away a stubborn strand of hair, kissed his parted lips. Then Emma arrived dragging a quilt and insisted we tuck him in. "Cozy is good when you're sleeping," she said. It was hard for me not to feel relieved that he was dead. His struggle had been tough to witness, and harder still was his determination, as a young man, not to allow the cancer to triumph. An hour before he died, he swore he wasn't going to. As Emma and I strolled around the lake on that vibrant morning, nature, heedless of the crisis she and I faced, celebrated the season with a riot of colour and a chorus of birdsong. She ate ice cream while I gently persuaded her that her father was indeed dead. Emma had been prepared by months of therapy for her father's death. She faced it, then, by throwing the ice cream at a duck and giving vent to her grief and fury about the unfairness of it all. She was now an orphan, her mother having died when she was an infant. When she calmed, I reminded her of the new life she faced, living with cousins, a beloved aunt and uncle, her own bedroom. And soon she let go of my hand and demanded another, bigger cone. Had it not been for Emma, I reflected, I might well have been a brand new widow, with Emma as my sole charge. I'd repeatedly postponed marrying her father because his precocious, impossible child had filled me with dread. Emma had greeted my arrival in her father's life with steely disapproval. And from then on, she and I vied for his attention, like competing mistresses. I had tried to like her, to win her over, but I had failed. Her ability to disrupt whatever brief harmony he and I could achieve as a couple in the few months we'd been together kept me one step ahead of her father's longing to make me his wife. At 30, trying to establish myself in the world, I was far from ready to make the necessary sacrifices that mothering Emma would demand. There were many occasions when a hasty escape to the sanctity of my apartment reinforced my resolve to remain single. And then he got sick. I sublet my apartment and moved in. Emma made plain her dislike of the arrangement, challenging my authority whenever her father was out of earshot. "You're not my mother," she'd hiss. "Why do you need to be here?" I had neither the patience nor the expertise to deal with her tantrums. Besides, my energy was taken up by honing my nursing skills. My lover refused further professional care. Relatives came and went, bearing healthy foods and advice, and whispering concern over what would become of Emma. His mother turned pleading eyes on me. But Emma and I were at war. After all, she was not without family, and I had a career to return to. As the months passed, nobody, it seemed, was in a hurry to take her on. There were days when I wept for her, as I wept for him. Then, in the final weeks, Emma's aunt stepped up to offer her a place to live. Soon, photographs of the cousins began arriving, along with warm letters of welcome, compounding Emma's confusion. She was torn between the lure of family life and her need to look after her father. "I'd like to go," she said, "but I'll have to wait until Daddy gets better." After her father's funeral, she began to chatter about her cousins and make up details of the new life that beckoned so brightly. There were moments of compliance, of affection between us, the affection of survivors. But mostly she stormed about, as obstructive and destructive as she could be. "You're not my mother. You can't tell me what to do," she'd say, stamping her foot. My heart ached for her, but I longed to walk away, to hand her over to her family. I wanted my freedom back. At the airport, she clambered monkey-like up the tall, angular frame of the aunt she barely knew and clung around her neck, distributing big, smacking kisses. Instantly relegated to the role of a mere chaperone, I felt the thrilling tug of my imminent release. Her aunt and uncle's house had been festooned with balloons and posters for her arrival. She was shown her bedroom, then sent off to explore the garden with her cousins, while her aunt and I fixed supper. "She'll be fine," her aunt said. "All she needs is a family and the love and attention we plan to give her." I sighed, feeling the accumulation of months of trauma lessen. Over the next 48 hours, Emma was absorbed into the dynamics of the household. Her aunt and uncle sensibly weathered the jealousies, irritations, and fights as I sat by, no more than an interested spectator. "My advice is not to actually say goodbye," her aunt said on my last evening. "Just slip away. She'll be asleep. We don't want to upset her. You can write." I didn't imagine that Emma would be upset about my leaving. She had hardly registered my presence since our arrival. I nodded my agreement and went to pack. I got into bed and tried to sleep and couldn't. It didn't seem right to creep away without a word to Emma. Around 3 a.m., I went quietly to her room. The light on the nightstand cast a pinkish glow, making her face appear flushed. I touched the tangle of her hair and bent over to kiss her cheek. "Bye," I whispered. "Bye, Emma." She stirred, opening her eyes, taking me by surprise. She smelled of a mingling of newly mown grass and shampoo. Wrapping her arms around my neck, she pulled me in close, murmuring sleepily, "I love you. I love you." Then she rolled over and sighed back into sleep. Hours later, driving to the airport with her uncle, I told myself that Emma's muttered sentiments had been semi-conscious at best, nothing to do with any affection she felt for me. Still, I felt jittery and strange leaving her. My much-anticipated escape was tainted suddenly with a hollowness that hurt. 5 days later, my phone rang.
"Thank God I got you," Emma's aunt began. "Look, I have to be honest, things are not working out."
Emma, it seems, was being Emma, bringing the full force of her insecurities to bear, upending the household. Her aunt and uncle had spent hours on the phone with the scattered members of her extended family, pleading for a reversal of their commitment.
"Nobody can help us," she told me tearfully. "If you won't take her, I don't know what we'll do."
She trailed off, leaving me with my heart thumping.
"I'm sorry," I heard myself say. "I can't. I put my life on hold too long as it is." After hanging up, though, I was flooded with doubt. Perhaps I thought Emma and I could have a life together. I found myself drawn again and again to the phone, hovering over it, and then resolutely moving away, until the memory of our embrace and Emma's sleepy, "I love you," swept over me. I decided to go get her. I would find a way to work her into my life. Yet after I made clear my intentions, friends, professionals, and Emma's family all intervened to make the case that my adopting such a troubled girl would be neither in her best interests nor mine. I was young, single, and in no position to provide the long-term support she would need. Even Emma's aunt backtracked, although in the end she was not able to find a home for Emma with family, and left her to be raised instead by foster parents, who ultimately adopted her and, by all accounts, gave her a wonderful life. This all took place 25 years ago. Emma is now a grown woman. I've been married for more than 2 decades and have been a mother of 2 for almost as long. Yet I think often, and with astonishment, of how close I came to becoming a mother then. How I had decided, in fact, that I would be triggered only by a sleepy embrace and a mumbled, "I love you." Such a small thing, and probably unintended. Nothing more, perhaps, than ramblings from a dream.
That's Zowie Ashton reading Ingrid Maitland's essay, The Triangle's Sharpest Point. Zowie told us why she wanted to read this piece.
It's got this unbelievably painful sense of nostalgia about a lost love and losing someone that you love and having them pass away. But also then having to deal with the extension of that love by way of a child and have that be mingled in all the different emotions that you're experiencing after a death and through grief and how messy that is. And I think I'm just a firm believer that love is truly messy and life is truly messy, and this just seemed to encapsulate so many beautiful, fragile layers of love, and I couldn't resist choosing it.
Thanks again to Zowie for reading this week's essay. You can see her in Betrayal on Broadway. And here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
What I loved about Ingrid's essay is how it reveals these sort of heart-opening moments that can change the course of your life forever. Or not, if you pass them by. And like, oh my God, like, what allows people to have those sort of moments of just vulnerability and risk and take a chance? And those moments are so rare in our lives, but what do we do? And how does it work out sometimes? I mean, a lot of people get married in those moments and have children in those moments or get divorced in those moments. But it's just, I think she does such a good job of revealing how loaded those decisions can be.
After the break, we'll hear from Ingrid Maitland, and we try to find the girl she lost contact with so many years ago.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We talked to Ingrid Maitland in early October, about 9 years after her Modern Love essay was published, and we started by asking her about Emma.
I do think about her a lot, and I do still feel quite guilty that I couldn't have done something more. Over the years, of course, you know, I have thought about her a lot. I've written her letters, which I've, of course, never sent. I've kept a diary, and she appears in the diary, you know, all the way through. Many, many years. Then when Dan Jones, you know, he called me one day, he said, we've got to try and find this child. And he said, I'll help you. We'll try. But we couldn't. We couldn't find her. And so the trail has kind of gone dead.
Ingrid says she tried to reach out to Emma's family back then to find out what had happened to her. But she says she never heard back from them. And although she still thought about Emma, Ingrid was also focused on her own family. By the time she and Emma parted ways, she had started dating Christopher, the man she eventually married.
I was very focused on making Christopher my future. His mother had died when he was a child. He was damaged. He was shy. He couldn't have coped with Emma. So really my choice was Christopher or making a life with Emma. And my choice was Christopher. And so for that, I would say to Emma, I'm sorry, you know, that I didn't have the backbone to say to Chris, I'm good enough, and if you want me, you have to accommodate this child.
Ingrid last saw Emma more than 30 years ago. Her own children are grown up now, and several years ago, in October of 2015, Christopher died by suicide. After his death, Ingrid moved from the East Coast to Denver, Colorado. She started a new relationship, too. But through all that, she hasn't stopped wondering about Emma.
I think it would be nice if people could know that Emma has survived. I wish I knew that for a fact. You know, that in spite of this little girl whose father died of liver cancer, whose whole family turned against her, and I, you know, left her as well, that she's okay, that, you know, life has a way of working itself out, and that she's beautiful and she's strong and she's happy somewhere and she's probably married with children. I wish I could find that out, and that could be the codicil to the story.
After the break, we find out what actually did happen to Emma.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
So there was one big unanswered question looming over this story. What had happened to Emma? We wanted to find out, so our producer Caitlin O'Keefe tried to find her. She got Emma's last name and did some sleuthing. After reaching out to four women with the same name, one of them responded with a message. It said, "I am the girl that you're inquiring about." We sent Emma a copy of Ingrid's essay, which she hadn't known about. And a few days later, we talked to her by phone. Emma told us what it was like for her to read the piece for the first time.
I went through about 15 emotions within about 2 seconds. It was, is this about me? Oh my God, this is about me. Why? And then I sat down and thought about it. And thought, well, it's her memories of my father, of their life, and a difficult child. And I wish I had the opportunity to say sorry to her for how I must have come across. But I was a child and I didn't understand the severity of the situation she found herself in as an adult trying to deal with someone that you love dying.
We wondered, does Emma wish Ingrid had adopted her years ago?
Yeah, I think it would have been nice if I had been adopted by Ingrid. But equally, I know that circumstances wouldn't allow it. I would have liked to have had her as a mother because I didn't really know my own mother. But what was planned for our lives wasn't for her to be my mother.
After that phone conversation, Emma and Ingrid asked to be put in touch with one another. And one morning, they talked to each other for several hours. After that conversation, they agreed to talk to us together, with Emma in a studio in London and Ingrid in a studio in Colorado.
How are you, Ingrid?
Hi, sweetie.
I'm all right,
lovely. How are you?
Yeah, this is sort of surreal. This feels rather surreal.
Ingrid agreed. Talking to Emma, who is 44 now, felt surreal.
Honestly, I could hardly believe it. I thought, nah, this can't be true, you know. So I was amazed. I mean, I just felt, because I honestly didn't know if Emma was alive or dead. That was, you know, I'd sort of given up. So I was very, very relieved to know that she was alive and well.
Then Emma told Ingrid what it was like to read the essay that had been written about her.
I broke down when I read it, I did. It made me very emotional. It made me cry. There were bits, once I'd read it, there was a little bit of anger there, and then I reasoned with myself and said, well, stop being so awkward about it, and I love it now. I absolutely love it. And I think it's mainly because through that story, we've been able to reconnect.
Emma told Ingrid what had happened to her after she left her aunt and uncle's home as a child. She says she lived in a children's home for 2.5 years. She shared a room with another girl who was only there on the weekend.
The rest of the week, I was on my own. Trying to fight my way through children that were older than me. Some were nice, some were rather nasty. I'm not going to actually explain exactly what went on. We'll put it under the heading abuse and bullying and leave it at that.
When she was 12, she was taken in by a foster family.
I don't know which was worse, being in the foster home or being in the children's home.
Emma says that after experiencing years of abuse in her foster home, relationships were difficult for her. When she was 29, she had a daughter with a boyfriend who eventually left her. Not long after, she started a relationship with the man who would become her husband.
We just knew that we had to be with each other for the rest of our lives and got married. And from that marriage came two other gorgeous daughters and a very happy life. And then, unfortunately, he passed away through illness.
After her husband's death, Emma says she had a breakdown.
Unfortunately, because I didn't cope with the death of my husband very well. My daughters were taken away from me. And my oldest one lives with her biological father and his significant other. And my two younger children are repeating part of my life and find themselves in the care system.
Emma says that because of the rules of the child protection system in the UK, she's not able to tell us more about what happened. For Ingrid, it was very hard to hear Emma's story.
I feel quite breathless listening to what this poor girl has been through in her life. And I had absolutely no clue that the whole thing was going to shatter the way it did. I did find myself often thinking about Emma and wondering what had happened and feeling a great sense of guilt and then feeling angry with myself for that and saying, get over this, this is not your problem, you know.
You have nothing to blame yourself for because it wasn't your fault. It was just the situation that life threw me into and threw yourself into, and at the end of the day, you did what you could and you did what you had to do to survive what you'd been through.
I am so...
It's all right.
I'm so impressed. I'm so impressed by Emma.
I wish you were here so I could give you a hug.
I'm sorry. She's such a lovely human being, and she's so strong and so brave. And I wish I could just give you a hug.
I tell you what, Inky, there is a way you could give me a hug.
Yeah?
Hug the microphone.
I'll give it a kiss. Mwah.
Did you want to talk later?
Yeah, I'll give you a call. I've got to take my doggies for a walk and then I'll call
okay,
you.
Okay, sweet.
Okay. Okay.
That's Ingrid Maitland and Emma Hilson. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Additional help this week from Catherine Brewer and Martin Kessler. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.